ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday the 9th of February. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, fronting up, the Reserve Bank Governor quizzed about interest rates, inflation and tax cuts. And forest fight, Tasmanians banned from the state's forests over logging protest. Now the matter's heading to court.
A lot of the community do use the forest for bushwalking and fishing and so, yeah, it is very important to the community. I don't think that they should be banning people indefinitely at all because it's long. It's state forest. It belongs to the people of Tasmania.
The pandemic paved the way for a population surge in regional areas around the nation, taking some pressure off big cities to house millions. But there's now a desperate need for more properties to house our growing population. Interest groups have gathered today for a National Regional Housing Summit in Canberra. The summit will look at the answers regional Australia could provide in Australia's broader housing crisis. Here's David Taylor.
Housing in regional Australia is facing its own unique crisis.
And we are in a pinch point. And what you're seeing is a consequence of that, that people are having to, you know, purchase rundown hotels just simply to house their workforce.
That's Regional Australia Institute CEO Liz Ritchie. She says regional centres across the country were struggling to house people before the pandemic, and now it's at a point where working families are facing homelessness.
You'd have to go back to the 1950s to see where we became a much more urbanised nation, to know that that pendulum is swinging back towards regional Australia. And that is why the longer-term planning is absolutely so vital.
That longer-term planning begins in earnest today in Canberra. The summit is focusing on the types of housing already available in regional areas, the extent of home ownership and the rental market. There will also be an attempt to shift the goals of regional Australians from owning a quarter-acre block to apartment living.
I don't think it's the death of the quarter-acre block, but what you are seeing is that the regional communities are changing. The whole profile, the demographic mix is changing. So younger people don't want to have to look after a garden. They want one and two bedroom apartments, townhouses, low maintenance. We're busier than ever before and we just are looking for that mix.
But once you've convinced people of the benefits of apartment living, you've got to get to building. And Master Builders says builders are already behind on projects. Chief Executive Danita Warne.
In terms of people, the reason why housing at the moment is costing 40% more than what it was pre-COVID is predominantly because of skill shortages. Master Builders Australia has estimated that we need another 450,000 workers into the industry to meet the Housing Accord targets. That is a significant number.
The summit brings together local, state and federal government, along with representatives from industry, peak bodies and the not-for-profit sector. The purpose, however lofty, is to shape the future of regional housing policy and investment. Housing Minister Julie Collins says the government's focused on building 1.2 million homes over 5 years.
What I'm focused on as the Federal Housing Minister is supply, supply and supply. We don't have enough homes in Australia and we don't have the right houses in the right places. What I want to do is get on and get more homes built right across Australia.
The push to develop more regional housing has attracted the attention of charity groups too. Anglicare Australia Executive Director Casey Chambers will be advocating for more regional social housing as opposed to public housing at today's summit. She says social housing, which puts a roof over working Australians on low incomes, is a critical step to easing the national housing crisis.
We're seeing people who have full-time jobs who are homeless. We're seeing people who've got kids at school who are living in their cars. And we're hearing that if you've got a car to live in, then you're not making it to the top of the list. Now, by anybody's definition, that makes for a housing crisis.
Okay, so what do you think is the solution and how can Anglicare help with that?
So we're putting money into negative gearing concessions and into Commonwealth rental assistance, but we're we're not putting it into actually housing people. So we've got to build social housing. Just building housing and expecting it to trickle down into affordable housing hasn't worked for 30 years and it's not going to start working. So we've got to turn where we're putting that money. We don't need more money, we just need to actually target it.
The summit will deliver its findings to a number of federal ministers after the event.
David Taylor reporting. Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock has repeated her warning that the prospect of interest rate cuts remains distant as long as inflation remains high. But she's confirmed the RBA is constantly thinking about just when it can press the rate cut button and says the board considered a range of scenarios before leaving rates on hold on Tuesday. Ms Bullock faced her first grilling as RBA Governor before the House Economics Committee in Canberra this morning, and our senior business correspondent was watching. I spoke to Peter Ryan a short time ago. Peter, it sounds as though Michelle Bullock is having an each-way bet on whether or when rates will start falling. How much pressure is she under to send a signal that relief is on the way?
Well, Rachel, under enormous pressure, but this is all about Michelle Bullock continuing to manage expectations about rate cuts. She told the committee this morning that, yes, it is good news that annual inflation has slowed to 4.1% in the most recent quarterly reading, but that while the CPI still has a 4 in front of it, well, that's not good enough because inflation needs to get back down to where the Reserve Bank needs to have it, slap bang in the middle of a 2-3% target. Now, overwhelmingly, Ms. Bullock is worried about the risk of continued high inflation or inflation rebounding if businesses and consumers start thinking the emergency is over and factor higher prices into their psychology. So as she said earlier this week, sustained inflation is a lot worse than the 13 rate hikes since May 2022. But given the pressure to cut rates, not ruling anything in or out, and optimism that inflation is slowing, Michelle Bullock confirmed the RBA board can plan for rate cuts even before inflation hits that magic number the RBA wants to achieve.
Do we have to be in the band at 2.5% before we think about doing that? No, I don't believe we do. But we do need to be very confident that we're going to get there. You said earlier, you talked earlier about the lags in monetary policy. It's true, but we do need to take those into account. So that's sort of the reason we're cautious and why you see all around the world, the central banks are cautious. They've stopped raising rates, but they're not yet ready. Many of them are pushing back a lot on this. They're not ready to say, done, job done, yet. It's no good just to go in and then pop out again. Got to be convinced that we're back in the band around about the midpoint and we're staying there.
That's Reserve Bank Governor Michelle Bullock speaking in Canberra this morning. And Peter, did the Reserve Bank Board consider a rate cut or a rate rise a few days ago when the rates decision was made?
Well, Rachel, Michelle Bullock was quizzed on this, but she'd only say that the board considered a range of scenarios leaving rates on hold. She said was a consensus decision, which suggests a rate cut or a rate hike might have been debated. But all this will change and we'll know a whole lot more in coming meetings when we get an idea of how members might have voted without attributing names. And we'll also see the minutes of the RBA meeting the Tuesday after next. Away from interest rates to hard cash, Ms. Bullock spoke about the new $5 banknote, which will no longer feature the monarch, meaning King Charles will be replaced by an Indigenous design. And the RBA will be asking the public in March and April to share how First Nations culture and history can be represented on that new $5 banknote.
Peter Ryan there. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Former US President Donald Trump is waiting on a Supreme Court ruling that could see him struck off the ballot in at least one state for his role in the January 6th attack on the US Capitol. 3 years ago, thousands of Trump supporters invaded the US Capitol building in Washington, and the state of Colorado ruled that made the former president ineligible to run again. Donald Trump is appealing against that decision in the Supreme Court. If he loses, it could spell disaster for his campaign. Angus Randall reports.
America's highest court is just metres from the US Capitol, where thousands of Donald Trump supporters attacked the heart of America's democracy 3 years ago. The Supreme Court will decide whether the assault on January 6 should bar Donald Trump from running for president again. Outside, his supporters and detractors are gathering.
If you've sworn to abide by the Constitution and protect it, and then you lead an insurrection, you forego your right to continue to hold a public office.
And the voters definitely should have the say, not the courts.
Five people died in the Capitol invasion. Donald Trump wasn't there, but his speech in Washington earlier that day urged the crowd to march on the Capitol and fight like hell. In the state of Colorado, that was enough to ban him from running for president in the state. The case was brought to the state court by 91-year-old lifelong Republican Norma Anderson.
This is very personal to me. I've lived a hell of a long time, and I've gone through a lot of presidents, and this is the first one that is trying to destroy the Constitution.
The Colorado case is being appealed in the Supreme Court and hinges on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the US Constitution, which bars anyone engaged in insurrection from holding public office. Trump lawyer Jonathan Mitchell says the rule doesn't stop them from campaigning for office.
Even if the candidate is an admitted insurrectionist, Section 3 still allows the candidate to run for office and even win election to office, and then see whether Congress lifts that disability after the election.
Donald Trump did not attend the court hearing. He's confident the decision will go his way.
The Supreme Court is a beautiful thing to watch in many respects. It's unfortunate that we have to go through a thing like that. I consider it to be more election interference by the Democrats.
If the Colorado decision is upheld, it could see other states block Donald Trump from the ballot, making it difficult for him to win enough votes for the presidency. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh questioned lawyer Jason Murray, who represents Colorado voters, on whether the court should wield this level of power.
Think about the right of the people to elect candidates of their choice, of letting the people decide.
This case illustrates the danger of refusing to apply Section 3 as written, because the reason we're here is that President Trump tried to disenfranchise 80 million Americans who voted against him, and the Constitution doesn't require that he be given another chance.
Donald Trump's challenger for the 2024 election has also found himself in legal difficulty. Today, a special counsel investigation found President Joe Biden willfully retained classified information about the war in Afghanistan and other security matters when he left the vice presidency in 2017, but he will not face criminal charges. The president says the case is closed.
Bottom line is the special counsel in my case decided against moving forward with any charges. This matter is now closed.
Donald Trump is also being investigated for holding on to classified documents at his private home.
Angus Randall. The Russian president has used his first interview with Western media since his invasion of Ukraine to again blame the eastern expansion of NATO for the war. Vladimir Putin told Tucker Carlson that Ukraine is an artificial state and the fighting won't end until their neighbour is denazified and the US stops supplying Ukraine with weapons. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president has fired his top military commander after long-running tension over the country's failed counteroffensive. Rachel Hayter reports.
In his first interview with Western media since the war started almost 2 years ago, the Russian president blames the United States and its so-called satellite states for his invasion of Ukraine.
It was the United States that led the genie out of the bottle.
Sitting down with former Fox News broadcaster Tucker Carlson in Moscow, Vladimir Putin again pointed at the eastward expansion of NATO as a threat to his country's sovereignty.
After 1991, when Russia expected that it would be welcomed into the brotherly family of civilized nations, nothing like this happened. You tricked us. I don't mean you personally when I say you. Of course, I'm talking about the United States. The promise was that NATO would not expand eastward, but it happened five times.
The Russian president says he tried to warn the West what would happen if it continued.
We were trying to persuade them. We were saying, please don't. We are as bourgeois now as you are. We are a market economy and there is no communist party power.
Vladimir Putin also made clear he considers Ukraine an artificial state, and he does not see Ukrainians as distinct from Russians.
I say that Ukrainians are part of the one Russian people.
Mr. Putin says his war won't end until Ukraine is denazified and the United States stops arming them.
If you really want to stop fighting, you need to stop supplying weapons. It will be over within a few weeks. That's it. And then we can agree on some terms. Before you do that, stop.
The interview comes as Russian anti-war candidate Boris Nadezhdin was disqualified from running in next month's presidential election. And Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has sacked his military's popular chief, Valery Zelushny.
I decided to renew the leadership of the armed forces of Ukraine. It's not about surnames, and even more importantly, it's not about politics. This is about the army system.
The man known as the Iron General will be replaced by General Oleksandr Sirsky, the commander of Ukraine's ground forces. Retired Australian Army Major General and military strategist Mick Ryan believes General Sirsky has a relatively higher tolerance for casualties.
In the Battle of Bakhmut, there was a very, very heavy attrition of Ukrainian armed forces for weeks and weeks and weeks, whereas Zelensky, in the southern counteroffensive, when it became clear after less than a week the approach was going to result in high casualties, he changed the operating methodologies.
On the streets of Kyiv, these Ukrainians are unsure whether the leadership change is the right decision.
I don't think this is the right time. This is not the time to fire the army chief. I think that we know our enemy, and it's not Zelushny.
The president probably has a better view of the situation, but I want to say that horses should not be changed at the crossing.
The military shake-up comes at a difficult time for Ukraine on the battlefield. Troops are facing acute ammunition shortages, and vital military assistance has been held up in the United States. Congress failed to back an aid package for Ukraine worth about $100 billion due to Republican opposition.
Rachel Hayter reporting. Robots in the home, smart kitchens, smart bathrooms, digital healthcare, and even your own virtual assistant. That's the not-too-distant future for Australian households as the National Broadband Network reports significant growth in bandwidth demand with the proliferation of artificial intelligence. Despite the ethical and technological hurdles, the NBN co-chief is predicting AI will be life-changing, rivaling the introduction of the internet and the iPhone. Gavin Coote reports.
As demand for ultra-fast broadband skyrockets, the boss of NBN Co, Stephen Rue, thinks Australian homes are on the cusp of a tech revolution.
Things like robots at home, smart kitchens, smart bathrooms, vacuum cleaning, security locks, for example. I do think our lives will be different. If you think about our lives before the iPhone, think about our lives before the internet and how today is different, it will accelerate. The changes we will see will accelerate.
To meet the growing demand, the government-owned telco is upgrading the fibre links to about 7,000 homes and businesses each week. And Stephen Rue thinks the proliferation of artificial intelligence makes fast connections even more crucial.
What we're seeing is growth of data ongoing. We saw approximately 10% growth of data in the last 12 months. There's been a consistent growth of data over the last decade. In fact, back in 2013, we were consuming what's called 40 gigabytes a month on average. Now it's up, more than 10 times that today.
David Tuffley is a senior lecturer in cybersecurity at Griffith University and shares the NBN Co boss's vision for AI in homes.
Most people will be familiar with the assistance of Google and Alexa, Amazon's Alexa, but in a fairly short time, it's going to evolve into something more like a personal assistant that is able to make appointments for you, that is able to book travel, able to book yourself in at a restaurant, all kinds of things. And that's where the big tech companies are aiming.
So, is Australia's broadband infrastructure up to the job?
Associate Professor Mark Gregory from the RMIT University School of Engineering thinks it's well equipped for the future.
Because the optic fibre that is in the ground today is able to carry far more data than it currently carries. And the cost of the electronics at either end is far lower than it's ever been before.
The biggest impediment Mark Gregory sees to the uptake of AI in homes is the current telco business model, which charges users for the amount of data they use.
By doing that, what they're effectively doing is putting a series of hurdles in front of companies that are looking for new ways, new approaches to introduce technology into homes and into businesses.
As for the ethical and cybersecurity risks, David Tuffley from Griffith University thinks they can be effectively managed.
I say this because humanity has had a long-term love affair with dangerous technology. Really going all the way back to fire, when we first started using fire, it was so useful, but it could also burn down the village. But because it was so useful, we just figured out how to use it safely. And I believe very strongly, and I've got good reason to think this, that we do have the ability to manage those risks that are inherent in the AI.
And while NBN Co. will benefit from the increased demand, for now, its balance sheet is firmly in the red, with an after-tax loss of $696 million for the first half of the year.
That report from Gavin Coote and Peter Ryan. Tasmania's state-owned forestry company has banned a group of Tasmanians from entering more than 800,000 hectares of state forest, including driving on the roads in their community. Conservationists have labelled the move unprecedented and a misuse of the law. Now it's headed to court. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
It's a state forest. Council Road, my boundary. If I step over here, I'm trespassing.
Marie Jenkins lives in the forest in Miuna, a remote part of Tasmania's northwest.
The forest around Miuna is the cool temperate rainforest, and it's very special because a lot of the community do use the forest for bushwalking and fishing.
Much of the bush around her is part of Tasmania's forestry estate. Over the years, she's seen it change.
I've lived here for 30 years, and over that 30 years, I have watched an amazing amount of temperate forest be clear felled over those years. It's just come to a time now that it really should stop.
Marie and a number of others in her community have spent weeks protesting logging by state-owned forestry company Sustainable Timber Tasmania, right next to her property. She went inside the coop, which is public land, and was moved on by police. But then she received an unexpected letter.
Last time we went in, we actually got a prohibition order. Which actually means that we cannot enter any state forest in the whole of Tasmania, which is ridiculous. That means I can't access a 100-acre rainforest block that I own.
Marie is one of 19 people who received an indefinite prohibition order. Many of the others are also locals. The orders ban them from entering any permanent timber production zone land and from using any forestry road. All up, it covers 812,000 hectares of land across Tasmania.
I don't think that they should be banning people indefinitely at all, because it's wrong. It's state forest. It belongs to the people of Tasmania.
Scott Jordan is a campaigner with the Bob Brown Foundation. He's also been issued with a prohibition order.
Okay, over the last 3 weeks, 19 people, predominantly local people, have been given these new prohibition orders. They're banned now from 812,000 hectares of state forest forever.
Mr. Jordan argues Sustainable Timber Tasmania is misusing a law designed to keep people safe.
It's absolutely unprecedented. This is an overreach of the greatest magnitude. The part of the act they're using to give these prohibition notices refers to closing areas off in the events of fires, in bridge collapses, in road collapses. It's not meant to punish people who have taken their right to publicly protest against the destruction of these forests.
The case is now headed to Tasmania's Supreme Court.
It's clearly an attempt to try and stop protest, and we think it's unlawful.
The World Today asked Sustainable Timber Tasmania for an interview, but it declined, saying the case is now before the court. In an earlier statement, the company said harvesting at the Northwest Coupe has been subjected to a significant number of visitors. It says the law allows authorised officers to request a person leave and not re-enter permanent timber production zone land and forestry roads if they think the person might prevent Sustainable Timber Tasmania from performing its functions.
Alexandra Humphreys and Adam Holmes with that report. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When three American soldiers were killed in a drone attack on a US base in Jordan, there was a flurry of talk of World War III. It may have been over the top, but the stakes in the conflict in the Middle East have risen dramatically. Today, host of the Iran podcast, Nagar Mortazavi, on what could come next. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.